You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay, so tonight we're going to be looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 2. It's sort of a continuation of what we started last week. And in this passage, the Koheleth, the teacher, or more accurately, the philosophy professor, serves up a withering attack against human ambition. And he attacks this idea that we can live our lives for success and achievement, and that we can build a foundation on top of those things. Let's begin. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. In verse 4 through 6, which we sort of glossed over last week, the teacher says, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. We argued the first week of this series that the Koheleth is probably Solomon from the Old Testament. And what we know of Solomon was that he was a great man filled with wisdom and that he had a great prodigious mind, as well as a lot of these different activities that he undertook during his life. We know that he built the temple, and that took him 7 years. It was splendid in appearance. And that his own palace took twice as long because it was twice as big. We know from other accounts in the Old Testament that he built citadels. He built entire cities in Israel. And really, this was sort of the golden age of Israel's history because of Solomon and his great work. He says in verse 5, I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. Interestingly, this word parks in Hebrew is the word paradis. And that's actually where we get the word paradise from. So Solomon was trying to create his own slice of paradise here on earth. We're also told that he planted all kinds of fruit trees inside of these parks and in the vineyards. Interestingly, this same phrase actually comes up three different times in the creation account in Genesis chapter 1 through 3. And it describes what the Garden of Eden was like, that it was filled with all kinds of fruit trees in them. Now, we don't know for certain whether the Koheleth was trying to allude back to this period in history, but it's possible that he was trying to create his own paradise, his own Garden of Eden. But instead of allowing God to provide for him, instead he was trying to do this with the toil of his own hands. Then in verse 6 he said, I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. Again, we know from archaeology that Solomon created magnificent structures throughout Israel. In fact, there is one reservoir that they uncovered many years ago that is about the size of a football field and is about 30 feet deep. And so this was a massive, massive reservoir that fed this large semi-arid region. So Solomon was an accomplished man. He prided himself on building and creating. And so, how do you think he evaluates his life? I mean, obviously, if you've been sitting with us through Ecclesiastes, you know how this turns out. Verse 17, so I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me, and all of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And so it's not exactly what you would expect. You would think the people who are on the top, who are the most successful, would be able to look at all of the fruit of their labor and feel a sense of pride and accomplishment and happiness over that. And yet Solomon looked at that and said, I hated my life. You know, a lot of times we set out to make our lives better. We work really, really hard in school in order to get into that program that we think will get us that career, which will give us that kind of lifestyle and prestige that's going to make our lives happy. And some of us have been working really, really hard throughout our lives to get to that point. And finally, in our early and mid-20s, we've arrived at this place. We have the lifestyle that we've been longing for. We have that degree and that job that we thought was going to make us so happy. And we have to admit that even though our life is pretty good, we're looking around and thinking to ourselves, I'm slightly disappointed. I'm a little bit disappointed with all of this expectation that I was placing in these aspirations of success and accomplishment. No wonder you see so many people changing career paths after already getting a degree, going and getting their master's, going into different fields, completely different from what they studied. Thinking that if only I can go and do something different, then maybe then I will feel content. Maybe then I'll feel happy. You see, Solomon didn't have that problem. He was at the top. And he went further down the path than any of us will ever go and realized that it was a dead end. He says this in verse 18 and 19, I hated all the things that I toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish, yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So he's like, how do I know that all of these things that I've gathered for my life, all the things that I've accomplished, that the next generation is just simply going to ruin it? It could be that Solomon was prophetic. Maybe it was that he was looking at his son, who was going to be the heir apparent, and thought to himself, this is not going to turn out good. We know that after Solomon died, his son Rehoboam actually ascended the throne. And it was interesting because Solomon lived this lavish lifestyle, but he did so on the backs of the Israelites, taxing them, making them work extremely hard. And so each representative from the tribes of Israel came to Rehoboam and said, please, if you decide to ease up on us, if you ease up on our taxes, then we will follow you. And so Rehoboam was like, give me some time. I want to think about it. And so he took 3 days and he met with the elders who served under Solomon, his father, and said, what do you think I should do? And he said, well, I think your father treated the people harshly because he lived such a magnificent life, such an opulent life. I think that you should listen to the people and they will follow you. And then later, he goes and hangs out with some of his younger buddies, probably his college buddies. And they're probably sitting around drinking. He's like, what do you think I should do? The people came to me and said, if you ease up on us and make us pay less taxes, we will follow you. And as they're discussing this, here is what their friends or his friends said to him in 1 Kings 12, verse 10 and 11. The young men replied, this is what you should tell those complainers who want a lighter burden. My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Yes, my father laid heavy burdens on you, but I'm going to make it even heavier. Now, what a weird statement. My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. I'll let you unpack that during your personal time with God. And so what did he do? He listened to the younger men, and guess what happened? The nation of Israel split in half. And that was within a week of him reigning. It took all of but a week to destroy this incredible kingdom that Solomon had built. And really, Solomon says, there's nothing new under the sun. What has been will be again and always will be. Interestingly, in Time magazine, they studied how incredibly wealthy people pass on generational wealth and what happens to that. Stephen Lavelle estimates that his grandfather, who founded the John Forsyth Shirt Company, had a fortune of at least $70 million in today's dollars. But through a combination of bad decisions, bad luck, and alcohol dependency, the next generation squandered that money. This is typical when you see people who are coming from wealth and they haven't earned it themselves. What they do is they decide to go into a profession that's not really going to pay off their bills, and it's not sufficient for their lifestyle. So what do? They subsidize their lifestyle with their wealth. And within a few generations, that's gone. It continues, 70% of wealthy families lose their wealth by the second generation, and a stunning 90% by the third, according to the Williams Group Wealth Consultancy. And so Solomon is saying, look, what is the point of amassing all of this wealth and money when your foolish children and grandchildren are going to just squander it away? All of this is meaningless. He goes on later in verse 21, and he says, for a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all that they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. So he says, you may labor and you may accomplish, but whatever you have, you're going to leave behind when you die. I heard this story about how a wealthy man wanted to be buried with his money. And so he decided to call three pastors, and he gave each of them an envelope of $100,000 in cash. Shortly after doing this, the man died. And so each of the pastors, as they went to the gravesite, laid the envelope on the man's casket before it was laid into the ground. And so afterward at the reception, one of the pastors broke the ice and said, so, did you put the full $100,000 in the envelope? And the pastor was like, well, there were some church repairs, and so I needed to take $20,000 of it, but I gave the rest away. And the other guy seemed relieved that he was talking to. He's like, yeah, same thing. We had this mission trip to Guatemala, and we were short, so we decided to take $30,000 of it, but we gave the rest away. And the other pastor was standing there, and the other two look at him, and they're like, well, what about you? He's like, I gave it all back in the form of a check. You know, when you die, whatever you have, it's going to be left behind. All these things that you think are so precious, so valuable, those things are going to be meaningless. You can't take them with you. I mean, Solomon says this where he says, naked I came into this world and naked I will depart. And so he says in verse 22 and 23, he says, what do people get for all of their toil and anxious striving for which they labor under the sun? All their days they work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. So he says, first of all, that hard work brings pain. And what he's talking about here is just the sheer exertion that goes into working hard day after day. Work just wears you down. And that's if things are going really well. There was a study many years back. They asked a ton of people, what would you do if you had an extra hour in each day? So if you had 25 hours in a day instead of 24, what would you do? What do you think that they said? What do you think the 85%, the majority said? Sleep. They're like, we would sleep. He says, too, that all of their work leads to grief. And this grief that he's talking about is just this sense that something is missing, that there is this desire to create a sense of self from the things that we do, from the things that we manufacture, the products that we think are going to help people. But really, it's not about helping other people for the most part. It's all about trying to create a sense of accomplishment that we hope will satisfy us. And yet what happens? It always ends in grief. You know, the work-based life always comes to grief because there are always unexpected things that happen. Who saw a global pandemic putting many, many people in America in furlough? Whoever sees an economic downturn that leaves people penniless and without jobs? You see, when you live a work-based life, it always comes to grief. And so really, if things are going really, really well, then your life is filled with pain. And when things are going really, really bad, it's filled with grief. But that's just during the day. We're told at night, their minds do not rest. What are we worried about? What's going to happen tomorrow? Well, it's one of two options. It's either going to be grief or pain. So why are we even worried about it? It's going to be bad either way, right? According to Solomon. Well, skipping down to Ecclesiastes chapter 4, Koheleth has more to say about this. He says, again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. He said, for whom am I toiling? And why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. He says, for whom am I toiling? You know, one of the things that we are constantly doing when we work, when we're striving, when we are constantly reaching for the top, never satisfied with where we are, you know what we're doing is we're looking for recognition. We're looking for praise. And we're not looking for it in a place that's actually going to satisfy us. Because even though we get that recognition, even though we get that acclaim that we want so badly, where people are clamoring over the work that we've done, that sense of dissatisfaction indicates that the problem is, it's not about the work, it's not about other people, it's all about us. It's all about me and being able to construct my own sense of self based on my performance and the things that I do. And we're told this, what a sad picture. There was a man who was all alone. Why was he all alone? Well, it's likely that because of his overwork, because of his obsession with working, that his neglect actually destroyed his family. Why doesn't he have any friends? Probably because he didn't have any time, too busy. Or maybe he actually was stepping on the heads of those that he was trying to climb over top in order to reach higher up the ladder. And so he's all alone. You know, one of the things that's really ironic about this is that we believe that the thing that's really going to make us happy is success, recognition, accomplishment. And in this pursuit, this insane pursuit for those things, we actually push aside the things that actually make us happy. Our relationships. The people that we love. And often you see people later on in life, in retirement age. What do you think they're saying? Are they saying, you know, my biggest regret in life is that I wish I would have spent more time working and building my career? You know, when you see people on their deathbed, they're never saying, hey, pull out my diploma, pull out my awards. I want to see him for just one last time. What are they saying? They say, I want to be surrounded by the people that I love. You see, the things that make us most happy in life happen to be the things that God says make us happy. People, relationships, love. Not this egotistical, driven desire and ambition to be noticed and to be successful. It's a trap. Henry Ford says, "I don't believe a man can ever leave his business. He ought to think about it by day and dream of it by night. Work not only makes us a living, it gives us a life." How many people live this way in our culture? So many. Some of you are living this way. Some of you are under this delusion that if I could just accomplish more, if I could succeed more, if I could add more letters after my name, then I'm going to be happy. He says, "And I saw that all the toil and achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." So he says, listen, axiomatically, right? He's not saying that in all cases, achievement springs from envy. But remember, this is Hebrew wisdom literature where he's simply saying, when I look around and my eyes observe how people live, the majority of people are toiling, working so hard because they envy another person. You know, when we look around and we see how other people are living, we associate that lifestyle with the type of success and wealth that they have. And so we strive to get what they have. And so what's happening is the people below are striving to get what those above them have. And those people who are at the top are trying to keep those who are below at bay to try to solidify their legacy, to make sure that nobody touches their greatness and their legacy in life and history. You know, this is what drives 44-year-old men to try to win another Super Bowl ring, their eighth. This is interesting. Sports Illustrated in 2010 actually highlighted Nick Saban's second national championship victory. They said, "For the second time in six years, the stern-looking coach stood on stage surrounded by overjoyed athletes holding a crystal football over his head as Nick Saban dutifully went down the list of dignitaries that he needed to thank. The expression on his face could be best described as a kind of semi-grimace." Like, I just got to get through this. I'm annoyed that I have to be here. When he won the national championship. They go on to say, "At the pinnacle of his sport, after leading Alabama to its first national title in 17 years, Saban reminded us that those best equipped to win championships are often the least equipped to celebrate them. I guarantee you," said a smiling Terry Saban as she watched her spouse of 38 years, "he's already thinking about next week." "Did the couple have plans?" Terry said, "He'll probably give me 2 days. And then he has to meet with some of the players about going out for the NFL draft." 2 days? Quote, two days, she repeated, "and I'll take it." You see, the people who are on top, they're constantly striving to stay on top. You know, the people who don't take their identity out of their work and accomplishment, don't overwork. They're not constantly pushing the needle into the red line to try to succeed because they know that work is about doing a really good job and playing my part, not trying to exalt myself. Now, there's another kind of way to approach this, which is to underwork. And it's for the very same reason. We feel like we're not getting the recognition or the money or the acclaim that we deserve. And so what do? We say, well, who cares? It doesn't matter anyway. And so we decide to underperform. And so it works both ways. We're told in verse 5, "Fools fold their hands and ruin themselves." So one thing that we should not walk away with here is the thought that work is bad. That what we're suggesting is that it's just better for you to sit around and not do anything. Be lazy. Because there's really tons of passages in the Old Testament and New Testament that speak out against this. In fact, Solomon, who wrote this, wrote Proverbs where he decries the person who's being lazy. He says in Proverbs 6, verse 10, a little extra sleep, a little more slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, then poverty will pounce on you like a bandit and scarcity will attack you like an armed robber. So he's not saying that work is bad, that we should just sit around and loaf. Instead, he's saying that when you try to create a sense of self based on your performance, that it leads to this feeling of despair and that it's all meaningless in the end. He says, better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. He's saying here, listen, better one handful of quiet or tranquility than two handfuls of furious activity. You know, this word tranquility just means a sense of quiet, a calm. And you know, this is the kind of calm that you can't get just by going on a restful vacation in the mountains or sitting around out at the beach drinking a margarita. This isn't the kind of rest that you get away from work. This is the kind of rest that you have in the work. Only the kind of rest that God Himself can provide. So how do you find this rest in your work? I think one of the best passages on this is Matthew chapter 11, verse 28 through 30, where Jesus says something very interesting. He says, come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Why don't we unpack what he means by this? First of all, he says, come to me, all of you who are weary. And this word simply means to exert oneself physically, mentally, or spiritually, to work hard, toil, strive, and struggle. This means to work hard, to really exert yourself. And so there's a weariness that comes from that, even if your identity is not tied up in your achievement and success. Sometimes putting in a hard day's work will leave you exhausted. And he says, too, those of you who are burdened. And, you know, we often feel a burden for trying to perform or to live up to a certain standard where we are looking at our lives and we are placing certain expectations on ourselves. Judith Shulevitz wrote this New York Times op-ed where she suggested that people should bring back the Sabbath and that people should go to, you know, taking one day off of work to rest. But she points out that that by itself is not enough. She says the machinery of our self-censorship must shut down as well, stilling the eternal inner murmur of self-reproach if you want true rest. You know, that machinery of self-censorship, you know, you go into a situation where you feel like you can't be yourself. You're trying to fit in. You're making sure you're not saying something stupid. You're presenting something at work, and so you're careful about how you say things, so that you're not misconstrued. And so that self-censorship can wear you down. She also says, also to still the eternal inner murmur of self-reproach. What is that inner internal murmur of self-reproach? It's that feeling that we have these expectations that we need to live up to. You know, either that's expectations that we place onto ourselves that we feel like we're not living up to. Maybe to some extent it means living up to the expectations that we feel like our parents have on us. Or maybe having the expectation to deliver and hoping that we don't screw things up. And you know, what oftentimes happens is when we underperform or we make mistakes, or we get feedback for the work that we do, there is that sense of self-reproach where we tell ourselves, you didn't do good enough. You failed. And that keeps us up at night. That sticks with us. You know, one of the things that I think we often tell ourselves is this: the quality of my work is the measure of my worth. How many of us live this way? Where we look at the quality of our work as a basis for our worth as a person. Well, he says that if you follow me, you will find rest for your souls. You know, this kind of rest is something that Jesus says will only happen if we take his yoke upon us. Now, this is a little bit odd, right? When you think about rest, rest is relaxation, not pulling a cart, not putting on a yoke and pulling a load. You know, sometimes we can get all of this rest and yet still feel exhausted. That's pretty much what the pandemic was like for me. I don't know if you felt that way. I've never had so much free time in my life and yet felt so exhausted. You know, I just recently got a fitness watch. And I got it because I want to track my heart rate as I'm riding my bike. And one of the features that was really interesting on there is it has a sleep number that you get if you wear your watch throughout the night. And it's pretty interesting because it has a pulse oximeter that looks at the blood or the oxygen saturation in your blood. It's got a gyroscope so it can tell how much you're moving around and tossing and turning in the middle of the night. And so I don't know how accurate this thing is, but at least it gives you some sort of score telling you whether or not you had a restful night of sleep. And it's really discouraging. Every time I wake up, I'm like, this thing is basically yelling at me and criticizing me, saying, you had poor sleep. You are a bad person. But one of the things that's really interesting is that scientists have found that even if you get 8 hours of sleep, it doesn't matter what the length of your sleep time is, if you never actually go into this mode of REM, rapid eye movement, you could get 8 or even 9 hours of sleep and wake up the next day still feeling exhausted. And so in the same way, Jesus is saying, you know, you could take as many vacations as you want. You could try to take as much leisure time as you want. And yet you will never, ever get true rest for your soul. Only I can give you that. And he says counterintuitively that it's by taking his yoke upon us. What is a yoke? You know, a yoke is a farm implement where you basically have this contraption that hooks up to a beast of burden that carries a load, sometimes a plow or a cart. And interestingly, it was said of a disciple who went to be with their rabbis that they were being yoked to their teacher. So they followed their teacher, they lived with their teacher, they served their teacher, they spent years with their teacher, just like what the disciples did with Jesus for 3.5 years. And so Jesus was saying, if you yoke yourself to me, if you follow me, you will find rest for your souls. You know, our culture strains to understand this way of thinking. You know, when you tell people, if you want to have true satisfaction in life, what you should do is you should follow Jesus and devote yourself to him. And you know what people will say to that? They'll say, I will never do that. I will never let anyone ever have control over my life. I am independent. I am living my own life, and I'm not going to allow anybody to tell me how I ought to live. And yet, one of the things that we see from people who reject God's leadership is this sense of inner turmoil and restlessness. Because essentially, when you decide that you don't want to acknowledge God and His presence and follow Him, you're on your own to make sense of this life, to have significance spring out of the things that you do. Jesus says, take my yoke upon you, which implies that you're already yoked to something. Everybody's yoked to something or someone. And so Jesus is saying, listen, detach yourself from this thing that you are yoked to and hook yourself to me. Because my yoke and my burden is light. I can offer you true rest. F.B. Myers says this, to all of us, Christ offers rest, not in the next life only, but also in this life. Rest from the weight of sin, from care and worry, from the load of daily anxiety and foreboding. The rest that arrives from handing over all of our worries to Christ and receiving from Him all that we need. Doesn't that sound wonderful? Not having to worry, not having that foreboding constantly with us, but having that sense of rest, knowing that all of our worries are going to be handled by Christ. Now, you know, this rest for your souls really is an assurance of a secure standing before God because of what Christ has done. One of the wonderful things that comes from the Christian life is that God gives you a new sense of identity. And it's not something that's fake. It's not something you have to keep telling yourself. It's something that's yours, whether you believe it or not. And what God says is that when you come into a relationship with me by receiving Jesus and what He has done, I now consider you my children, my son or my daughter. And so it doesn't matter if you fail. It doesn't matter if you don't live up to your own expectations. It doesn't matter if you fail. I love you anyway. Just like a parent loves their children, even when their children are wayward. Even when their children reject them. Even when their children don't listen and fall flat on their face. And so there's tremendous freedom and a relief that comes from knowing that we have this security before God. Secondly, a relief that our sense of identity has been anchored in Christ. You know, we try to anchor our identity in all sorts of things. The things that we own, our success, the relationships that we have, our status in society. And ultimately, when we do that, we're creating a sense of self that is temporary, that can be taken from us. By contrast, what God can offer us is true security, true identity that's anchored in what He has done. We don't have to grope around wondering and hoping whether or not our lives matter. God says your life matters and has value because of what I've done in Christ. So let's draw a few conclusions. The first thing is, you can actually enjoy work when you don't take your identity from your work. You know, when you're striving to create a sense of self from your work, from your achievement, your work becomes burdensome. I go through periods of this where, you know, my performance in these situations or in leadership and leading this church becomes a sense of identity. I try to derive a sense of significance from that. And, you know, I'll go on these vacations with my children and my wife that are so fun and so relaxing. And then I come back to work feeling a sense of dread, and it wears me down. And that's because what I haven't done is I haven't gotten rid of that inner eternal murmur of self-reproach and realize that God accepts me and loves me despite my performance. And so when I can present myself to Him as who I am in Christ, as His child, that sense of tension and stress and worry, that burden is gone. Secondly, work's most basic function is to provide for yourself and your family's basic needs, not as a means of manufacturing significance. You'll hear people say, you know, I realize that one of the most important aspects of work is so that I don't get depressed and that I have something to do. That's good. But most people around the world work because they need to provide for their family. Don't get it twisted. Your work is not about you and making a sense of self. It's about providing for others. Finally, there's a kind of work that's meaningful due to its enduring quality. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, Paul says, "Always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain." You know, God has given us a mission, important work to do, sharing the good news of Jesus, loving people, serving people. And God says that kind of work has enduring quality. That'll never be taken away from you. And yet what's interesting is that even in the midst of this kind of work, it's easy to put your identity in that as well. You would think that Christians would be exempt from this kind of this belief that I'm trying to create a sense of self and significance from Christian work, but we fall into that trap all the time. A friend of mine who's a missionary said this, really interesting. He said, "It's important to have a calling to be a missionary, but it's devastating to make an identity out of being a missionary." You know, when we take our identity out of even Christian work, it eats away at us, it wears at us. You know, finally, there's this figure in the Old Testament. His name is King Omri. This guy, there's not much said about him in the Bible. There's relative silence. And yet what's crazy is that when you look at the archaeological evidence in the ancient Near Eastern area, it just yells of his accomplishments. Archaeology has discovered all of these different artifacts that indicate that King Omri was one of the great kings in Israel. In fact, the Assyrian archives actually call the nation of Israel the House of Omri. Most scholars believe that Omri was one of the greatest and most accomplished kings in Israel's history. And yet what's interesting is that not much is said about him in the Old Testament. There's maybe six verses, one of which is this: Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not walk with him. What an epitaph that would be. Forever recorded in the Bible. You know, here's the thing. There are two histories that are being recorded right now. There's the history that people are writing based on the things that we think are so valuable, people's accomplishments, great feats of learning and discovery. And there's another history that God is writing, filled with people who nobody see, filled with people who are serving behind the scenes, who are not getting any sort of recognition, but whom God one day will say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Yes, Lord, I think all of us, to some extent or another, feel that inner restlessness that plagues us. And we know that most of the time it's this feeling that we have that we don't measure up, or that we need to strive to succeed in a way that gives us recognition that ultimately will give us value. And I pray that we can learn to critique that and see just the emptiness of that and realize that true just true rest and calm comes from knowing you and trusting what you have to say about us. And we know too that, for those of us who have never actually come into a relationship with you, that you offer peace. Not the kind of peace that the world offers, but one that comes through what your son Jesus has done. And so I pray for anyone who just senses that this restlessness that they feel is a result of combating you or resisting you over the years, that they would invite you into their lives and experience the peace that surpasses all comprehension. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.